good management is about maximum extraction. Right. And I studied in business school. And one of the things I was surprised about, because it was the opposite of the other things I was studying, is good management, things that were rewarded and applauded, were things that figured out how to get more out of people with less and ideally no resources. Right. Like that would be fantastic management. Right. We didn't have to train. We didn't have to buy equipment. We didn't have to give them healthcare. And look at all the stuff we got. Now, that's an exaggeration, obviously. But anytime we're bringing people together with an aim, maybe even singular aim, of extracting maximally, that's a toxic start.
Welcome back, guys, to another week here with Drew and Alex. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Drew.
So this episode is a big one. It's wide-ranging. We'll get into the details with the guest here in a second. But as far as a segue goes, we do talk about breaking bread with friends and the importance of sharing meals. And do I have a story for you? So the other week, maybe last week it was, I decided I was going to make a delicious meal from scratch. I believe, if I remember correctly, it was sort of a venison tortellini dish with a pasta sauce that required me to go to the store and get a white wine, a dry white wine. And so I decided Sauvignon Blanc, pretty standard dry white wine. So go to the grocery store. I have my three-year-old in the cart and we are walking past the self-checkout area, which is adjacent to the wine section. And anybody that's familiar with self-checkout knows that there's always like that one person working at self-checkout that just needs to feel busy, even though they have nothing to do. So here we are heading towards the wine section. I pause for a brief second. I don't remember why, but it's enough time for this individual who's working at the self-checkout to think, oh, this person probably needs some help. So she comes up to me and she goes, "What kind of wine are you looking for?" And I said, "Oh, just a Sauvignon Blanc." She goes, and I will never forget this for as long as I live. She goes, "Oh, nice. Sounds Italian." And points me towards the Italian section. And normally, when somebody, you know, makes a kerfuffle, I'll just kind of roll with it and be like, "Oh, yeah, totally." But I could not allow myself to sit there and pretend that Sauvignon Blanc sounded Italian. So,
well, speaking of how it sounds, Can you say it one more time real quick?
What am I? Sauvignon Blanc?
There's a whole extra syllable in there. It's Sauvignon.
Sauvignon Blanc? Sauvignon like Blanc. Maybe that's a southern accent. Sauvignon.
Yeah, you're definitely like blurring through the syllable in the middle.
Sauvignon Blanc?
I'm pretty sure.
Sauvignon Blanc.
I don't know. Some wine
regardless.
Correct me later, but
I think we can both agree it's not Italian. So this
That's
lady
true.
Goes,
we can agree
lady,
on that.
This lady goes, "Sounds Italian." And oh my God, inside of me, I said, "You know, I think it's French." And she goes, "I don't know." And so I headed over to the freaking Sauvignon Blanc section, found my wine, came back. But oh my God, for a split second, I was like, this can't be real life. Sounds Italian. I'm not convinced that you're right about the pronunciation of that.
We can't do it like mid-recording because it takes too much effort, but I can get Google to like pronounce it.
Well, it's
for
like
me, I'm pretty
it's
sure.
Like we should have asked our British guests these questions because they say aluminium instead of aluminum, and they say skeletal. They say skeletal instead of skeletal. So,
what did I hear recently? I was listening to like a podcast or a presentation or something, and they were saying cardiovascular differently. It was like I couldn't. It was some like really famous researcher and stuff too. So I couldn't really like criticize their way, but I don't remember what it was.
I
think it was cardiovascular. I'm not sure.
It's kind of only one way you could, unless they emphasize the wrong syllable, which is what you do when you say ACFT.
Sauvignon Blanc.
Could you hear that?
Yeah.
Hold on.
Sauvignon Blanc.
Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, there's a completely separate syllable in there that you're not saying.
Listen, no, I think being from North Carolina, I think it's a little bit of a different word. But again, the point is, it's not Italian.
It's fair.
Sauvignon Blanco, that might be Spanish.
Probably.
Anyway,
we're getting in trouble now.
Segueing this back into what I talked about at the beginning, today's episode is all about community.
Yeah, there's some breaking bread involved. There's some general principles for community building involved. We are today talking to Charles Vogel,
who's way out of our league.
Absolutely out of our league. We, just as a brief anecdote, we generally offer to our guests that they can have the MP3 of the episode ahead of publication if they want to review it and decide whether or not there's anything in there that they need edited out or something. Charles immediately said he does not have time for that.
No, I don't have time for that.
This is a guy who's way too busy for peasants like us. So
here we are.
So Charles' work is used to advise and develop leadership and programs worldwide within organizations that include Google, Airbnb, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitch, and Amazon.
And Mops and Moes.
Also Mops and Moes. He has instructed and presented at organizations including Yale, Harvard, Stanford, and perhaps most importantly, the United States Army. He works with Google in several capacities, including as a trusted thought leader for the Google School for Leaders, which develops 20,000 Google managers. He's also a founding member of the Google Vitality Lab, which works toward innovating healing strategies. He is the author of 3 books, one of which we focus on during this episode, which is his first book, international bestseller, The Art of Community, which shares how both community and belonging can be built through time-tested principles and rituals. It won a Nautilus Book Award for business and leadership writing. His other 2 books, he wrote Storytelling for Leadership, and he wrote Building Brand Communities. In his 20s, Charles served in the Peace Corps in northern Zambia. You'll hear a little bit about that during the episode. While there, he witnessed inspirational community inside his rural village. After the Peace Corps, he founded a social impact documentary film company in New York City. His PBS film projects won many awards, including the Amnesty International prestigious Movies That Matter Award. And as we'll also dive into during this episode, at least briefly, he holds a master's in divinity from Yale, where he studied spiritual traditions, ethics, and business.
So I think needless to say, he's quite accomplished. And I think what was interesting about this episode is that when you talk about building communities and creating, I think we could probably safely say creating movements, just bringing people together in an intentional way, as we were talking and kind of learning about his work, I think it became pretty evident that the military and probably other organizations, but in this case, the military, often goes about it in the wrong way. And we dig into that a little bit. Like you mentioned, he does have some experience working with the military. But hopefully you guys walk away from this episode with some pretty interesting nuggets to chew on that. I mean, for me and Alex, I think it kind of changed the way we think about this a little bit. So hopefully for you guys, it does the same.
And the episode's not explicitly about the military suicide problem, but it is definitely in the background for a lot of the conversation. You'll hear us discuss like interpersonal theory of suicide a little bit, which like foundationally talks about a lack of belongingness as a core part of what pushes people toward suicidality. And since Charles's work focuses so much on creating a sense of belongingness, it comes up naturally in conversations like this. So he acknowledges that he is not a suicide expert, but he is an expert on community, which plays a role in suicidality. And then we've gotten some feedback from a few listeners that we kind of took advantage of on this episode. And we kind of knew we had to, as soon as the conversation ended. It's one of those where it like you can immediately tell that this is going to be important. This is stuff that matters. So as soon as we got off the call with Charles, Drew and I hopped back on to kind of break it down real briefly afterwards. So stay tuned to the end of the episode for a few of our takeaways and why we thought it was so important.
And we'll say this publicly so that we lock ourselves in. That's something that we're going to start doing, hopefully with all of our episodes, especially the ones that involve guests, the ones where it's just the two of us. I don't really think we need to recap the end of them, but for the guest episodes moving forward, stay tuned after the exit music and you'll hear just kind of some quick takeaways from Alex and I to put a bow on the conversation. So grab yourself a glass of the well-known Italian wine, Sauvignon Blanc, and enjoy. I think that this will open up more conversation specific to maybe the military, but maybe more broadly based on your experiences. But I'm wondering if you can manufacture community. Like I know you've we'll get into how you build it organically, but can you, from a top-down manufacturer?
All right, so that's a loaded question.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I want to start there.
I think the short answer is yes, but manufacturing, I think, connotates something that's constructed. I don't like the connotation.
Sure.
I'm not going to distill that for this conversation. So my work at this point that you're talking to me, and there are several books out, right, is almost strictly speaking to people in leadership roles, both formal and informal, to connect people in ways that they want to connect them. Usually they're important to them. Otherwise, why are you investing in them? We are living in the loneliest era, probably of people history, certainly of American history, and the research is overwhelming on that. And I can talk about that if you care, if you don't believe me. Given that, there are obviously things that we can do to bring people together in ways that connect them, to make them more healthy, more resilient, and more adaptive. Full stop. Mm-hmm. If that's what you mean by can we create community, can we manufacture it? Absolutely. But it's not manufactured as in these people don't want to know each other. I want them to know each other. I'm going to turn screws, right, and throw rocks until they do it. Then no. And because there are certain premises that have to be in place. They have to be in place. If they're not in place, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. The first one is there needs to be a perception, also reality, but not only the reality, but the perception that there's a shared value and purpose. You don't believe me? Go fill a room of people who don't perceive any shared value and purpose, and good luck with that. Right. Now, they may disagree on everything, but if the one thing they agree on is we want our neighborhood to be safe for our kids, that's enough. Right. And I may not like you. I don't like you talk about. I don't like you doing the weekends. But if you're going to help me make our neighborhood safe for our kids, we can have a connection here about this. Right. But I need to perceive that. I need to understand that you, Drew, care about whether kids are safe in our neighborhood, and you're going to do something about it. And then if you don't give me a chance for that, that's not it. So that's at least one thing we need in place. Another one is it has to be safe enough. If Drew, you and I are going to sit down or walk around or build a playground in our neighborhood for kids, and I'm just not safe around you, like physically safe, emotionally safe, politically safe, spiritually safe, guess what? I'm not going to be spending time with Drew. Whenever we bring people together, we have to deliver what I call the three promises in my work. Whenever we're taking on a leadership role to bring people together, the three promises are people need to have freedom to say no to a gathering. If they don't have the freedom to say no, we have entered into the realm of coercion. Every event you've ever invited to that could have been fun, as soon as someone was coercing you, it was less fun, maybe totally sucked. Full stop, right? The second promise you have to deliver is that there's an opportunity to connect there. So if you come to help build a playground with me in our neighborhood, and I say, I tell you what, Drew, why don't you go on the far side of the lot and dig holes, and we're going to have you do that by yourself. That way you're not distracted by conversation. All of a sudden, this neighborhood community building playground project sucks, right? Mm-hmm. But if I send you over there with two other people and you're going to be digging and hauling dirt and talking about our neighborhood or the weekend, now this event doesn't suck so much. And then the third promise you have to deliver is you need to offer to people a way to grow that they want to grow. Now, meeting other parents in the neighborhood that want to keep kids safe might be enough, right? Hey, there's more parents here. We're going to keep kids safe. Good enough. Very often it's more. And if you think of all the communities that you've been returning to, be it sport or spiritual or civic, my guess is when you continue to contribute, you can now recognize they were delivering on all three promises. And when your participation drifted away, and maybe you didn't even know why, it's because one or more of those three promises stopped getting delivered.
Hmm. And I think the reason I ask the manufacturing question, at least as it exists in my head, specific to what I kind of see day to day in the military, is that, and we'll talk about probably a couple of these things, but you see a lot of things trending in the wrong direction in this space. Suicide comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And the kind of catch-all solution that seems to always be talked about is, you know, fostering community, creating community, team building, blah, 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 blah. And it's always top down. And then there's always questions asked on the back end when those kind of initiatives tend to fail of like, well, why weren't we able to create that community? And I guess when I say manufacture, what I'm thinking of is kind of a senior leader sitting there thinking about doing an event or hosting a thing, people come, like, you know, we have like suicide awareness 5Ks all the time. And it's like that. Okay. I don't feel like that's solving anything, if that makes
sense.
Yeah,
well, it's probably not.
Right.
So there are many reasons why events that are hosted fail. I don't even know where to begin. There's so many. So a big part of it is people who host these events have no idea what facilitates actual connection people show up. And so they're doing conventional things. And conventionally, we are now living in the most lonely era of American history. So if you're doing the conventional things, you're perpetuating a culture that has made us more disconnected and more isolated than ever before. And then you're surprised that people aren't connected or not very connected very much. One of the problems when people just create events, they don't know what they're doing as far as what's connecting people, is they're usually judged on something other than our relationships forming that help people be more resilient, more adaptive, and more healthy. They're usually judged on how many people showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Drew, if you give away gold coins, people will show up. Right? If you offer free winter tires, people will show up. That doesn't mean a whit that they're leaving with relationships that make them more resilient and adaptive when challenges are going on. Another thing that people are often judged on is, did you do it within budget? Well, how much you spent on pizza, how much you spent on garbage bags has nothing to do with, did the people who gave you their time leave with a relationship that's going to grow into something? And I see that all the time. In my work, we can talk about it here. I don't know how much you want to talk, but we can talk about like one of the principles that I find.
Yeah, people please.
Just absolutely don't know that creates toxic events.
Yeah.
So one of the fundamental principles I talk about when I'm training leadership is what I call the campfire principle. And I coined the term in my last book so that we could teach it easily. And the reason I call it the campfire principle is most people I meet have at least on one occasion in their life sat around a campfire and noticed when they stood up to leave, they were more connected to the people who sat at that campfire with them. Is that true for you guys?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So then the question that hangs is, do we need to get a fire pit every time we want people to connect? And the answer is no. But we can look at the criteria that made that possible. So the first one is campfires have people close enough that you can physically close enough that you can have a possibly intimate conversation. You might not, but you can't. And for the purposes of training leadership, I say for among strangers, that's five people or less. And the reason is, when you have more than five people, the number of relationships that are getting managed in that conversation are too many to manage to typically have an intimate conversation. You might get lucky. And if, you know, more than half of you are already close friends, then it's easier to manage those relationships, but bigger than that. Well, if you're being judged on how many people are at your event and you don't understand the campfire principle, you're creating an event that's literally the opposite of an event that people are looking for to connect. And then you're bragging about how many people were in that room or at that barbecue to connect people, when what we all want is an intimate experience. Now, you can create intimate experience at a bigger event, and you've all experienced that. You've been to concerts, you've been to festivals, you've been to barbecues where you noticed the best conversations you had, the people who you couldn't wait to follow up with and go on a hike with, you stood in a group of five or less and chatted about things that you understood, you share a value of something. Could be hiking. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So the first criteria is people need to be close enough. We'd say proximity. They need to be close enough to have a possible intimate experience. The second criteria is they need to have the freedom of time to have the conversation they don't want to have. And what we're fighting on this one in conventional wisdom is this belief that, well, if these people are going to show up at my barbecue, I better entertain them. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to get a band to play really loud. And if Drew is part of this military community and knows there are lonely people, family supporting military, guys coming back, and they want to, what you don't want is to stand in a place so loud you can't talk to someone who hired a band to entertain you. And then often people choose to do it in like a bar where there are, and I've counted sometimes, more than 10 screens going in a place where we ostensibly want people who are coming together for shared values to pay attention to each other. You know, on every one of those screens, without exaggeration, there are collectively people paid millions of dollars to grab our attention and distract us, right? when you think of all the ads and all the things the networks do. Why would you create an event in a space where people are being paid millions of dollars to distract you from the relationships that you say that you want people to form, right? And that's conventional wisdom. Guess what? People leave lonely. So we say you need to give them freedom to do that because many people, if I say, well, you got to listen to the band or you got to watch this movie or you got to listen to the person talk, then they don't have the freedom to have the conversation. And then the last criteria is all the conditions that would distract from the conversation that you want to have happen need to be handled. So you gotta not hire the band. And if there is a band and you're in charge of the event, you gotta make sure they're turned way down and there's places people can talk where there's no band. You need to make sure that if there are screens all over, they're turned off. You need to make sure that if someone wants to go around selling raffle tickets, that they cut that out at some point so that conversation can happen. And we can go on and on and on. And I'm flown all around the country now to conferences very often to speak. And I'm very often invited to events where someone says, well, we want all the speakers to connect. And we want you to connect the leadership of this hosting organization. And inevitably, it looks like it's hired by somebody who saw parties hosted in movies and bought all that stuff and have no idea what kind of event people want to be at if I really want to be in a room with a bunch of other people and know them better. The three criteria, I'll go over them again. People need to be close enough to have an intimate conversation. We call those campfire spaces as opposed to arena space, five people or less. I need the freedom to have the conversation I want to have, which is to say you haven't scheduled out my time while I'm there. And the last one is you have to handle all the distractions that would pull me away instead of filling the space with those distractions.
I got to say, I don't know if when we talked on the phone weeks ago, I explained what the concept of Mops and Mows is, but you just kind of laid it out indirectly pretty perfectly of like, we often measure the wrong things. We measure like how well we're doing it on our measures versus we don't measure the outcomes we were supposed to achieve. And I've had exactly the spirit. I didn't have the term campfire principle to describe it, but I've had exactly that experience working in like veteran nonprofit stuff. It tends to be measured by number of veteran interactions. And you get 30 people together and that's on the paper, a very, very successful event. You got tons of attendance. It's popular. But the most successful events that I ran in terms of actually connecting people were always like three-ish people.
That
looked pretty crappy on
in
paper.
In a quiet room.
Exactly. And those people got to communicate and there wasn't any structure and you just kind of chatted.
Well, there was a structure, right? But the structure was only enough that you felt safe enough.
Yep.
Aware that you were with people who wanted to be there to know you. And my guess is what they achieved, because there was enough structure to do this, is you understood that those people in the room understood who you are enough that you felt comfortable with them, and they accepted you for who you are in that moment.
How do you measure community?
For me, it's just qualitative. And I worked with Airbnb, and this is public. I can talk about it. And they distilled it down to two questions. They had a PhD working on their metrics, which I was very impressed that they had such horsepower on their metrics. And she distilled it down to two questions on they were bringing together hosts who are important for their business model. Do I feel more connected to other hosts? Do I feel closer to Airbnb? And for Airbnb, they want hosts to be connected even though they're ostensibly in competition. Right. Because as the market changes, guess who knows best how the market's changing and how to adapt to it? Guess, right?
It's not hosts.
Yeah, right. Other hosts.
So they're talking to each other and supporting each other on boards, then their inventory gets better. My favorite story is apparently there was a shift in more Chinese tourists, I believe in Australia. And the hosts were unfamiliar with hosting Chinese tourists. And it turns out Chinese tourists wanted slippers and rice cookers. But you don't know that until someone tells you that. And it's very easy, right? It's one click on an online shopping option. But their inventory adapted because they had connected the people who ostensibly were in competition, right? They were in community. They cared about the welfare of one another and the success of all of them. And then the question, do I feel connected to Airbnb, is to some effect about loyalty, right? Because they can list their inventory with any platform in the world. Airbnb wants to know, do you feel connected to us? Which I think is, it's a surrogate, right, for other feelings. Like, you think we're paying attention and we are supporting you. Mm-hmm. And that's good enough. And here's the thing, Drew. When relationships do what we want them to do when we most need them, most people don't file reports on them. Like, I know that you two are both really connected to the military community. And as you know, for years, I've been talking to military leaders and people dealing with veteran challenges. When people are having the worst days and their families are having the worst days because of it, and they call the people they feel safe to call and who will pick up and do something about it, they don't broadcast that stuff, right? So you and I may never know that that barbecue, that movie night, that hike, that walk around a lake saved a family. And we may never see them brag about it. We may never brag about it. We just have to be okay that we know that by creating these barbecues and these movie nights and these lake walks, we're saving families.
Well, and I mean, I think as you're saying that, I'm thinking of how you could extrapolate the point you just made to so many different metrics. Yeah. And it is one of the conversations that Alex and I have had on here numerous times with numerous people, because in the military setting, oftentimes programs are funded or defunded solely based upon what objective metrics they can show. Right. And if you host, you know, if I go and ask somebody for money to host a barbecue or an event, they're going to want to know, what are they getting from that? What are the metrics? What are the red, yellow, green stoplight charts? You know, blah, 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 blah. And it's just interesting to me. I don't have an answer to this question, but it's interesting that we, as an organization, struggle with, we've talked about suicide, suicidal ideations, all these mental health issues. We struggle with those. And then experts like you are saying that the solution is going to be found qualitatively. And oftentimes so I'm just curious, like, in your mind, how do you introduce that to an organization that exists in PowerPoint slides?
There's a whole much bigger question about what we presume we need to measure.
Oh yeah.
Right. And I don't know if we can tackle it here or if it's relevant to your audience.
Please.
You know, first of all, you know, most people are judged are you on budget and how many people showed up? And you know what? I don't care how many people came to eat your pizza if all they did was stand in a loud room, eat pizza, and leave. I'll give you an example. My wife works for a billion-dollar tech company. And in 2019, right before the pandemic, I went with her to a Christmas party in San Francisco. And for anybody who knows San Francisco, going there on a December night during party season and finding parking is a total thing. And I was very excited to go to this party because it was going to be the only 3 hours in the entire year where I was going to meet the people that my wife referred to as her work husbands, because she, on many days, spent more waking hours with them than she spent with me. Right. And I was going to meet these people, and she likes the company and she liked them, and she didn't, she would have left. And I went to this Christmas party that was on several floors of a rented out club, and it looked like exactly the party you would get if you gave a 25-year-old American Express Black Card and said, go to town. There was all you can eat French fries and hamburgers. There were 3 open bars, and there was music playing so loud everywhere that I could literally talk to no one. And I did some quick napkin math, and I figured out there were approximately 300 spouses and partners at that party who knew almost no one and could meet almost no one at this party that they were spending 6 digits on, and they're a billion-dollar tech company. Here's what I'm confident happened. There was a meeting within the next 2 weeks where they congratulated whoever ordered all that stuff and said, what a great party. Look how many people came.
Mm-hmm.
And what they taught me is, I never want to go to another event your corporation hosts. And if I want to spend time with my wife's coworkers, get to know them, people she spends so much time with, we're not going to your events. They measured things that give them no sense that they're creating toxic events. I don't think I was the only person who didn't know anybody there who said, I'm never coming back. And this is a waste of parking.
Hmm.
You're speaking to foundational issues that I think the military struggles with constantly.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I don't even know if they have an avenue. This is obviously just one company, but I don't think they have any avenue to understand how bad it is. I have so many examples that go on forever. So I have a friend who was studying my work. She took a job leading a school in a fancy school in the DC area. And when she showed up, the staff told her about all these events they have for the parents of the kids there. And these are fancy parents because they're parents who send their kids to private school in the DC area. And she'd studied my work. So she has an inkling of what contexts do we need to create such that people can create the relationships they're looking to create. When they show up, when they find parking, they show up, they're looking for something, right? And what she discovered was all they were doing as a school was spending money on catering. And the reason was somebody was tasked to create these events for parents. They ordered the catering and then declared victory if parents came and ate some of the catering. And of course, what they taught the parents is we're wasting your time if you showed up. So the way we create community, because we can't coerce people without working against our intentions, is we create contexts that deliver the three promises that people feel safe in, where the relationships they want to have can emerge. And we can totally learn to do that. And I'll be honest, it's not rocket science. And I've written several books on this, so you can go deep if you want, but it's kind of like singing. If you can learn to sing, you know, John Lennon's Imagine on key, you can sing it at birthdays and you can sing it in stadiums and it's going to work. Don't overthink it. And it's that simple. And the other metaphor I use is because we're so lonely as a people and we have all the measurables that go with that, the mental health stuff, right? You guys already wrote suicide. In a desert, you don't need a very big watering pot to bring up flowers. And we are all right now in a desert. So it doesn't take much. Let me tell a story. You guys can edit the hell out of me if you need to. I mean, you know about this, but we haven't talked about it we haven't recorded it yet. You know, some years ago, a guy named Eric, who was a new veteran out of the U.S. Army, was a fan of my book, and he recognized that one of the things he was missing coming out of the Army and serving in a lot of combat was a community to support him to take on his civilian life. And he realized that while he was in the military, the part of the military he was in had a culture of rugged individualism, where everybody around him was competing for rank, assignments, and training. And that type of competition may have been great in that part of the military. Turns out when he left and had a family to support and a civilian economy to be participate in, turns out that culture and those skills didn't roll over. And what he needed was people around him to help him be this civilian dad. And guess what? He found out that was true of people around him. So he could reach out to me. And together, because of the nature of my work, we created a dinner series that he called Warriors Breaking Bread, where he ordered steak dinners funded by a sponsor for guys to sit and share a steak dinner. But we ritualized the dinner. So it wasn't just eating steak. There was a context for relationships to form. And in that first year, he hosted 10 dinners. One a month minus the 2 months took him to figure out what the program would be in there. And he had a sponsor who was really excited to help veteran programs. And that sponsor is a guy named Mark. And Mark said to Eric, hey, it's been a year. I'd love to get some kind of report that says that what you're doing is helpful. It was not an aggressive ask. He just wanted something that said, hey, you're doing things that matter. So Eric went to the guys who came to the dinners and he said, hey, could you write something down for my sponsor so that he knows whether what we're doing matters? And these guys, of course, were, you know, vets of a lot of combat. They are not novelists. Well, I was in the room when Mark read what were in effect essays written by the guys who were attending those dinners, 10 dinners. And several of them, the guys shared with Mark that the dinners had saved their lives. And I remember when Mark looked up, the first thing he said was, well, that was worth it. The reason I'm telling you this story is that was 10 dinners in a restaurant. Not 10 states, not 10 chapters, not 10 programs, 10 dinners. And thank God Eric decided to host 10 dinners. And they're still hosting them, and now there are a couple programs around the country. But my point is that we don't have to lift that hard to make profound change.
I mean, it's hard to follow something that powerful. I think there's a lot people are going to take away from it. But I do want to touch on something, and you've kind of touched on this a couple times already. you briefly mentioned like the loneliest era is what we're living in. Mm-hmm. And we kind of circled around the idea of structure for these things. Mm-hmm. And I do want to briefly touch on your roots in divinity. You're a Yale Divinity School grad, studied mm-hmm. religion, spirituality, and things like that. And a fascinating anecdote I took from your book was that while church attendance is dramatically down, mm-hmm. we don't actually see as much of a dip in changes in like belief in God and spirituality and things like that. Mm-hmm. Are we kind of losing touch with the value of structured communities? Is that part of the issue here? Is it the things that traditionally provided some of these things, man, for society?
Touch on big subjects, Alex.
That's how we roll.
All you want to talk about is religious structure in America.
No easy questions. No easy questions, Charles.
You know how it's evolved in one generation? Is that all?
Nothing big.
Yeah, come on, give us something.
You guys know how to like swing big on this one, huh? So there's an author who's smarter and more wisen on the recent history of American religion. Her name is Diana Butler Bass, and I believe, if I remember correctly, the title of her book is Religion After Christianity, which at this point probably 10 years old, but the trends that she noted, I'm certain, are still valuable. And she argues, and I agree with her, that the religious landscape in the United States has not adapted to the values of Americans after baby boomers. And she does a better job than I can about listing what that value shift is. But, you know, what I can remember just extemporaneously here, one of them is, this is a very big brush here, so please don't think I'm labeling every American here, but to understand the trends that we're seeing. We are, who are younger than baby boomers, more interested in fairness over righteousness and participation over observation. And if you think of mainline services in America, circa the 1980s, there was a lot of watching and a lot of hearing of what's righteous. And we all have exposure to way more cultures, and we know more perspectives about history than people talked about in the 1970s. And so the world is way more complicated. And simple declarations of righteousness don't fit a complicated world. And they never did, right? Because they only fit if you're unaware of the complications of it. Especially when you meet people from, you know, radically different worldviews from radically different cultures, which is what America is full of now, right? I mean, certainly when we look at the diasporas in the 20th century from both Europe and Asia and Africa and Latin America. So the religious landscape has been unable to adapt fast enough to, quite frankly, create a place for spiritual nurturing that's relevant, and the numbers reflect that. My understanding from the research I'm familiar of, there's still a longing for spiritual maturation, connection, and for meaning. But if you don't have a context to nurture that, then what do you got? And when you walk away from a spiritually nurturing institution early, the last thing you saw was what they showed with people who are young, right? Which is usually very simple. It's simplified for young people. And it's hard for many people to understand that these subjects, religion, theology, ethics, are so complicated that people get PhDs in very, very narrow parts of these subjects. Which is to say, there's a lot of complication there if you look. But if you leave a church at 15 or 12 years old and think, well, gee, religion is just simple and stupid. Well, yeah, you got what 13-year-olds get. And that's probably why you left, because it's simple and stupid. We don't have institutions that help people keep on that journey and embrace that. And the numbers, you know, reveal themselves. So that's like one part of it. Another part, and this is a bigger soapbox, for at least 100 years, we have fetishized, in my words, a very strict scientific, material, or physical understanding of the world. Whereas if someone is interested in or wants to pursue something that's outside of a physical world, it seemed as outside mainstream, maybe silly, a distraction. Whereas in the real world, the real lived experience, people direct their whole lives because they're looking for meaning, right? I don't know if you two have partners that are very dear to you. Do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Drew's married. I'm in a relationship. Yeah.
Okay, so you both do. My guess is it's pretty clear to you that the people who are dear to you aren't dear to you because they're a particular collection of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen that you're familiar with. Like, full stop, right? Said differently, it is not that physicality that makes that relationship enriched, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I might spend a lot of time convincing you, well, you think you like them, but it's really neurochemical cascade of dopamine, right? Mm-hmm. And some hormones. And isn't that cute that you think that's, and you're like, no, that's not how it works, right? And I'm not just going to replace that partner with another collection of material and declare victory, right? Well, that speaks to your own awareness that the trans material is not only important to you, but so important to you, you actually prioritize your whole life around it. And when you have a culture that dismisses that, and so there's no education about that, you literally don't have the language to even be in the conversation. Now, that doesn't mean that you'd agree with what people say, or you would pursue it in depth. But if you don't even have the language, then how can you engage in that? And that's where we are as a country. And then there's also an issue that we tell our youth, it's not true, but we tell our youth, you're starting with a clean slate. The merit of your parents and your grandparents don't count for you. If you do nothing with your life, you are worth nothing. So prove that you're worth something. And you're going to do that by doing activities. And we'll know if your activities are good enough because you will get certain accolades. Well, several of them may be diploma. Some of them might actually be awards. Some of them might be rank. And when we see that you do that, then we'll know that you have merit, or at least not enough merit that we're not embarrassed. And you don't need to be embarrassed. Look, I played that game. I don't think we should take away all rank and awards and diplomas. But notice when we tell young people, and I say young, you know, meaning up through 30, you better be accomplishing stuff to not be a loser. Guess where the focus is? Guess what skills get developed to accomplish those focuses? Well, if connection, friendship, love comes from having the skills of a relationship with people you're not trying to beat for rank, for training, for diplomas, for scholarships, for awards, if that's where that comes and you're not practicing the game, let us not be surprised you wake up at 35 and you don't have those skills, you don't have those relationships. And it's not because you're a bad person. It's not because you kept your eye off the ball. It's because you're in a culture that told you, these are the balls you better pay attention to. And we're going to be embarrassed for you and about you if you don't.
As you're talking about this, I think I'm sure Drew is too, but I'm picking up countless parallels to things the military is struggling with on a number of levels. We've talked about the mental health and suicide thing. And I think we're going to come back to that in a little bit. But even without looking at that, like superficial level challenges that we see in the news all the time, the military is struggling with recruiting and retention kind of issues. And I wonder if there's a parallel to that comment you made about not keeping up with the values of mm-hmm. the current generation. Because I know, like, I was in the Army. I was active duty for several years. I'm still in the reserve. Any good soldier in the Army can tell you the values of loyalty, duty, respect, selfless mm-hmm. service, honor, integrity, personal courage. You know it.
Mm-hmm.
You're exposed to it every day. There's posters on the walls. If you drive onto a base, there's signs that list them all out.
It's painted on my stairs at work.
It's everywhere. But I think there's, like, if you get below the surface a little bit, you start to mm-hmm. run into, like, because of, like, more access to social media and, like, more knowledge of what's going on and things like that, you start to see more examples of, like, where leaders have broken with those values, or maybe those values yeah. don't apply in the situation that soldier's been put in, or whatever. All these complicating factors where I'm not sure the value system is speaking to and motivating and inspiring the people the Army is looking to attract, or the military right. in general. I say the Army because it's the one I know, but yeah. the military in general is struggling with this.
Well, it's the easiest thing in the world to put words in a wall.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't begrudge anyone doing it. And I think putting the words in the wall so there's a conversation about it is better than nothing. And it's the easiest thing you can do. Role modeling is the hard part. And there's a balance there. Like, part of the challenge of building community in an organization that's hiring people is often the organization overwhelmingly or exclusively views participants I want to say this without hyperbole. Well, good management is about maximum extraction. Right. And I studied in business school. And one of the things I was surprised about, because it was the opposite of the other things I was studying, is good management, things that were rewarded and applauded, were things that figured out how to get more out of people with less and ideally no resources. Right. Like that would be fantastic management. Right. We didn't have to train. We didn't have to buy equipment. We didn't have to give them healthcare. And look at all the stuff we got. Now, that's an exaggeration, obviously. But anytime we're bringing people together with an aim, maybe even singular aim of extracting maximally, that's a toxic start. You guys have relationships. You're obviously doing a project. You know people. We've talked about that. I already know how many days next year you want to spend with another organization that you know is only inviting you and wants you around, because they're calculating at every moment how they're getting more out of you than they're investing. I already know. Well, can you imagine then being a leader, military or civilian, and you're thinking, well, gee, I'm approaching these people who are important to me, the mission, to each other, to their families. And my overwhelming relationship is, how can I extract the most out of them, ideally by investing nothing? Ideally. Well, that's a toxic start. One of the things that we talked about, you know, before, Alex, is that the organizations that reach out to me at this point, I've noticed the through line is they're working on challenges that are so high stakes, people die when they get it wrong, which is why there are parts of the military that use my work. Overwhelmingly, that's military, both veteran active duty, education, and healthcare. And there are some rounding errors in there. Those are all, we'll call them fields, that people don't show up because they did a spreadsheet on how they could get the most out of life financially. All of them. In fact, the military people show up knowing it may cost them their life and they sign up anyway. Oh, and then they take the assignments that may cost them their life and they know it because they're not stupid. That's not signing up for an extractive relationship. That's signing up for a commitment based on values toward a purpose. Now, if I told you guys that I have an organization that's based on values that you're already living, healing people who are seeking healing, with a purpose you're already working on, I'm spreading the word to people who are looking for healing in ways that will heal them. Now you're interested in showing up. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fundamental. We can't frost over a fundamentally toxic approach bringing people together. Now, believe you me, people who have a maximally extractive aspiration want the frosting, right? But you and I both know that's not going to work. And if people's lives depend on getting it right in combat and their hospitals, we better get that straight.
And I'm just reflecting on the reality you mentioned of, like you cited healthcare, education, military. You're talking about people who are like kind of widely known to be undercompensated and get into the field for a sense of purpose and things like that. And then we build structures around it that start with that extractive mindset.
Right. That's right.
That drive people away from those fields.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Man.
And earlier, before we were recording, we were talking about the people who sign up for the most dangerous jobs where they know they're going to get shot. They know people will shoot at them. And we know that people sign up for that because they are so committed to serving, to being a resource for people who need them. And if we took that away from the mission, they wouldn't sign up.
Mm. So given all of that, mm-hmm. this is going to be a little bit of a sudden transition, but we have talked about this before and you knew we were interested in it going into it. Mm-hmm. But one thing I had recently discovered before my first conversation with you was Thomas Joyner's interpersonal theory of suicide. And in that, he argues that suicidal ideation is driven by a combination of perceived burdensomeness and thwarted belongingness. And then it's the capability that turns that ideation into action.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you've discussed here, your discussion of community building and the tools of how to do it, seems to address those problems at the source. Both perceived burdensomeness and thwarted belongingness seem to stem at their core from building effective, supportive communities. Mm-hmm. How much are you approached around the issue of suicide specifically? And where do you think we can go with that based on the work you've done around community more broadly?
It's hard for me to answer this because suicides is one of the concerns. It's a big one of people I talk to. So in education and military, active duty, it's a big deal. And I need to explain to people who don't know that suicide among our youth is so bad that our most famous academic institutions have literally changed their academic calendar to provide stress relief so students won't hurt themselves as much as they have. And our top, I'm just going to pick a number, 50 universities in this country cannot spend their budget fast enough to keep up with the mental health challenges of their student bodies. And these are the youth, by the way, in our country that did what the adults told them, got the grades, and then got into the schools adults wanted to get to. And those schools cannot meet the mental health needs. So do people approach me individually? I try to stay in my lane. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm certainly not an expert on suicide. And so it's in the background and it's a concern. I don't focus on suicide because I think that when we talk about suicide numbers, for example, we're often looking at the most extreme outcome of a culture that's disconnected. And there's a lot of pain going on before someone gets on that list. And there's a lot of pain in the whole family, right? It's not just that one list. And so I just don't focus on it because there's so much more beyond that. And it's part of the conversation, no doubt. And I know it's motivated a great many people who have reached out to me because they're dealing with those numbers. And my understanding is there is research to show that building relationships, friendships, has a remarkable effect on suicidal ideation. I don't know how much that's qualified. My work is about teaching people to bring people together in effective ways. And resilience is definitely one of the outcomes we want. What I share is when we do invest bring people together ways, Eric had steak dinners. We have people to call in the bad days. And if we don't have people to call in the bad days, then we only have the worst options available to us. And so I don't know how much the work is affecting suicide. I do know it makes a difference when people have someone to call. Oh, and by the way, if you know anyone's listening and they're thinking, well, gee, could I do something? Could I learn how to bring people together effectively? The number of friends that makes a radical difference in someone's life is exactly one. If you host one crusty bread and soup dinner and two people at the end of the table start talking and one of them makes a phone call when they're having a hard time because they had soup at your table, that's a life-changing experience.
Well, you said you don't focus on suicide much. Mm-hmm. You focus on things that are tangentially related to it, but not suicide as an issue itself. I'll switch then and talk about something you definitely do focus on because you brought it up a couple times in this episode. You bring it up in your book. I think the suicide stuff is in the news. The recruiting and retention stuff is in the news. There's an issue I hear about all the time because of working with fitness and nutrition and things like that that isn't really in the news that the military is reckoning with. And that's meal services for members mm-hmm. of the military. And I think part of the problem is that at the root of it, they're focused on things like meals per day, calories per meal, macronutrient and food group mm-hmm. selection in those meals, and all these very quantifiable things about how do you feed a person. And as we struggle with staffing and as we struggle with resources, you see that delivered in a very industrial style way, prepared meals, grab and go, whatever, kiosk is the new word that everybody loves. I want to just kind of give you a platform to talk about how like we're missing out on the breaking bread component of meals and how crucial that is to the whole community building thing.
What comes to my mind, Alex, is there is no community, military, spiritual, sport that we can think of that comes together and supports each other when times get tough and celebrate together when times are good. There's not a single one that you and I can think of they don't sit down and share meals. Full stop. I can't tell you from a scientific lens what's going on, but I can tell you, but there's at least 10,000 years of history. And if we break that, we are playing with very, very dangerous experimentation. And everybody in this call right now can think of several meals where we sat down and a conversation happened that surprised us and it changed our life. And when we're talking about a military recruiting out of the loneliest era of American history, let's throw some stats out just so it doesn't sound like Charles is being hyperbolic. According to the latest research, half of Americans have three friends or less. Not three friends at work, not three friends in their neighborhood, not three friends in their sports teams, three friends or less, period. One out of six American men report they have no close friends. So Americans largely don't have people to call when the times get tough. Largely, right? The military is recruiting out of this culture. The loneliest generation of this era are 18 to 24 year olds. 80% say they're lonely. Said differently, our culture is not teaching our youth the skills they need to create the relationships they need and want to handle the challenges of life. Call it resilience, call it adaptability, pick whatever words you want. We're not doing it. So once they're in the military, if they're not given the structures that we know for 10,000 years have allowed people to build relationships that make them resilient and adaptable, what kind of outcomes do we expect?
I think that speaks for itself.
One of the things that you've mentioned before that I was really drawn to and that I think touches on all of the things that we've mentioned is this idea of invitations versus announcements. Mm-hmm. And I want you to define those for people, but then I also want to speak to that kind of back to this senior leader, military hierarchical organization concept, mm-hmm. where when we see a lot of these initiatives get pushed out and all the pats on the backs and, hey, good job, look how many people showed up to the party. It's mm-hmm. announcement based versus yep. invitation based. And then yep. maybe as a follow-on question to that, how do you scale invitation-based initiatives?
Okay, those are really good questions, Drew. So for those who don't know my work, one of the fundamental ideas I teach to leadership when I'm invited to teach is this idea that all communities start the same way. And that's with an invitation. And you don't know of any thriving community that didn't have invitations to somebody sometime. In my work, we define an invitation as a request to spend time where the person invited knows that someone cares if they show up. I'll say that again. It's really important. It's a request to spend time where the person invited knows someone cares if they show up. We have a name for when there's a request to spend time, but the person invited doesn't know if anybody cares if they show up, and that's called an announcement. And I say that in very large rooms, sometimes with very senior leaders. And about when I'm distinguishing this, faces go white because they recognize that their organization invites no one to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They just shoot out announcements and then complain that people aren't engaged that much.
Or a flyer on the wall.
Yeah, flyer on the wall, sending out an email. It's ridiculous, by the way. I've had some people take my workshop. And then they say, you know, I'm thinking of one pastor who said she wanted to create an event for women in Oakland, and they're all professional women. They have jobs and kids. And she said, well, I'm going to use the invitation distinction and just actually invite them so they know that I care if they show up. It's not coercive. You can't show up, can't show up. You got a job and kids. She said she got a 100% attendance rate. Turns out all they needed was an invitation. That's what was missing. I talked to the head of a fancy school in New York. And because it's a fancy school, they have a fancy board. And he literally ran after me on the street of New York to tell me that after he'd learned about invitations from my work, he invited the board of that school to his home for dinner. And as soon as he made the invitation, he knew it was stupid because these fancy board members all lived in the Upper East Side and he didn't. And they wouldn't want to come all the way to his part of New York and what have you. And he said that all of them came. And they stayed so long, he had to kick him out of his house. The reason I bring this up is All that was missing was an invitation, and everything else was there. The interest, the time, right? So that's why invitations are good. And when we understand the power of, you said, how do we scale it? There's a number of ways to think about this. I only have so many seats in my home, and we host a lot of dinners in my home because I want to know my friends and we sit down and share meals. But I've only got so many seats. Let's just pick a number, 8. But I want to invite more than 8 people, and I assume people have kids and relatives they got to take care of. So I'll invite more than 8 and say, Alex, I'd love for you to join us for dinner on Friday. That's a time where you sit down, share a hot meal with people who want to know better. Please get back to me soon so that I can reserve a seat while we have space. And if Alex takes 40 hours to get back to me, then you know, he knows he was generally invited, but now the spaces are full. So that's one way. You know, one way. Another way is to understand that people want intimate experiences and they want to be invited. So then I turn to other people to help me host to make those invitations. And we recognize the invitation simply because it's clear to us somebody cares if we show up. There are people in this world where if they get a text that says, hey, dude, we're having beers on the patio, you should join us, that's a perfectly good invitation to them. That is not a good invitation for me, right? Which is simply to say the form of the invitation, the words of the invitation are going to vary depending on who you're inviting. The important part is they simply understand that this is not an announcement. I really would like you to join. If you can't, we're not coercing you. Please go take care of your grandmother, right? But just know that we'd love for you to be there.
Hmm. All right. Before we let you go, I want to ask you 2 closers. And we haven't asked these in a while, but I'm curious in your responses to these because you are quite cerebral. And the first one is, what's one thing you've changed your mind on in the last 3 to 5 years?
The complexity and the importance of spiritual growth in achieving the outcomes we're looking for our culture has shifted for me. That I understand more and more that we have to include that in the conversation and focus on it. And this reliance on talking about science and studies and best practices ain't going to do what we want to achieve.
Mm.
And, you know, I briefly referenced it, but like you two are not in your relationships because there's a paper that explained to you these are the best relationships to be in, right? Or that you should stay in them because you looked at cutting edge research on romance and or brain chemistry and you're like, oh yeah, this is a relationship. You know, thank God I worked that one out. And as soon as we keep the conversation blind from the importance of that, we're always going to be missing a piece. Now, what that looks like when we bring it in, how we talk about it, that's going to change, right? But I've definitely changed my understanding of how important that piece is when we're talking about the real pain.
All right, second question. What's one thing you've doubled down on in the last 3 to 5 years?
Oh, can I say more than one?
Oops, absolutely.
Oh, good. I want extra credit. So another one is I'm getting older and I've really doubled down on my fitness, understanding that I got to focus on that to do the work I want to do and be the person I want to be and show up the way I want to show up. I just got to do it. Like I can't pretend. And part and parcel with that, I'm a big skier. I'm actually a ski instructor. And I've doubled down on investing on that part of my life because you got to travel to it. It's only a certain part of the year. It's not the cheapest thing you can do. And I have a young son. And I know a couple things are true. He's living in a culture that's not going to naturally take him outdoors, have him exercise to a point of fun exhaustion, have him hone a skill. And when he's with me, spend time with adult men in friendship that are doing things we love while we look out for each other. And I know you guys spend time in the mountains. If you're in the mountains with other guys and you're going fast, safety is a thing. And I need him to spend time with men in friendship, learning skills and attending to each other as a role model so that when he's no longer with me, he knows what that looks like and he has those skills.
Man, definitely extra credit there. I think those two were brilliantly put. So thank you so much for coming on. I think this is one of those conversations that's going to resonate with hopefully a lot of people in a lot of different places. So thank you.
I'm delighted to be invited.
As we close, I do want to do something I'm supposed to do on podcasts that we've never done before, but a call to action as we end this stuff. And one of my classic moves is to quote our guest to our guest. Mm. So I'm going to quote you to you. And your line was, if you want to create community right away, practice telling people who matter to you that they matter to you. Mm. And so I'll leave that one as our call to action for listeners here of, if you take like one thing away, if you want to do something right now, let somebody who matters to you know they matter.
Boom. Done.
All right, guys, something a little bit different on this one. This is something we've been asked to do before, something we've been wanting to do for a while, but we're going to do a quick 5-minute after the episode, what we took away from our discussion here. And I think this conversation in particular pushed us in the direction of having a little recap. We immediately called each other. I don't know, like Drew called me, but it was at the same time as I was pressing the call button to Drew. because we had to have a discussion right after this episode. So we're gonna break it down.
We're going to record it instead.
Some super valuable takeaways from this one. And I'll start off with one. I think we really got to the root of what the whole point of the Mops and Mo's lens is in this conversation. And it's the difference between, are you actually moving the needle on the outcome you are looking to achieve, or are you just doing stuff because you can measure it and put it on a graph and convince someone your program is worth spending money on? I think that was at the heart of this. And I think we got to it in a really important way on a really important topic.
I think a big takeaway for me was, and we've talked about this on numerous episodes with numerous guests, but things that seem to come up frequently as being the most important to positive change are hard to measure. And Charles talked about the kind of campfire effect, and you know, having even one person at a dinner table you can connect with could be a life-changing conversation. And as he was saying that, I was thinking of briefs that I've been in with senior leaders, and if I were ever to say that only one person showed up to the thing, it would be considered a failure. But here we have an example of, what if that one person that showed up had a conversation with one other person and it literally saved their life? So I don't know how you kind of, I don't know how that dichotomy can coexist. I don't know how we solve for that. Maybe we don't, but I think it at least merits opening up some discussion about, to your point, like, man, are we really measuring what matters, or are we just measuring things because we're scared that if we don't, we'll get in trouble?
I think a thread I noticed, and we didn't have time to dive into some other questions we would have loved to talk about on this episode. We just ran out of time, but we were introduced to Charles by Newton Chang, who we've had on the podcast before. And we asked Newton and Charles a really similar question, and they answered it in a really similar way. Newton does health and performance for Google, and we asked him how he measures the effectiveness of his programs. And he said, one, he doesn't. And two, if he were going to measure something, even though it's not terribly measurable, he would measure meaningful social connections as the primary metric for his program. And Drew asked Charles, how do you measure community? And he said, you don't. And I think it's fascinating that both of them, doing programs in this space at really high levels, focused on qualitative, meaningful, individual things rather than things you can put in a spreadsheet and make into a graph and measure relative value units or something on.
Brief to Congress.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe, I mean, I think that you and I both talked about this being a thread that we'll pull on, but I'd be curious how other people at other organizations, or I guess at other levels within even just the military, have maybe kind of solved for that or haven't solved for that. Because I know there's a bajillion examples of situations where you do realize that what needs managing, and this is, what did we call this? The Hammond effect or something last time?
What did you call it?
What did I call it? Yeah. What gets measured gets managed, but what needs managing isn't always measurable. I think that there might be something to that. So yeah, that was a fun episode.
I'm looking forward to conversations coming off of this one.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.